I'm Dan Rodericks, and this is Midday Friday. Former Baltimore Police Commissioner Leonard Hamm joins us today to talk about cops, crime, and police leadership in post-Freddie Gray Baltimore. Leonard Hamm joins us in today's second hour. Up front, some perspective on Governor Larry Hogan's surprise decision to close the long-troubled and decrepit Baltimore City Detention Center. We'll hear about a local nonprofit's offer to trade laptops for guns in an effort to reduce violence in the city and get more teenagers interested in careers in technology. Stan the Fan Charles of PressBox talks about the Orioles and the start of Ravens training camp. And live from Studio A, the Kings of Crownsville sing a sweet summer tune. Midday Friday, after the news from NPR. Good afternoon, everyone. Dan Rodericks here, and welcome to the Midday Friday show. Thanks again for joining us. It's a two-hour show, as usual. In the second hour today, a conversation with former Baltimore Police Commissioner Leonard Hamm. Leonard Hamm was a police commissioner in Baltimore 2004 through 2007, serving under two mayors, Martin O'Malley and Sheila Dixon. Today, we'll look back on the era of zero-tolerance policing under Martin O'Malley, a strategy that Leonard Hamm says he privately disagreed with. We'll also get Leonard Hamm's take on the past year in Baltimore and American law enforcement, his thoughts on the potential value of police body cameras, and because he's just written a book of recollections and reflections, we'll hear about the Baltimore Leonard Hamm knew growing up and as a young police officer and as the first African-American commander of the city's Central District. Also, his personal life, including his stepdaughter's tragic struggles with heroin. That's all coming up in the second hour of our show today, a conversation with Leonard Hamm. Stan the Fan Charles will be with us later in this hour of the show from PressBox to talk about the Orioles and the start of the Ravens training camp. The Orioles have some news that we've just learned about a deal that they've made to get a outfielder who can hit the ball quite well. Stan will fill us in later in this hour of the show. We'll also be treated to the sounds of the Kings of Crownsville. They're going to sing us a sweet summer tune to end this first hour of the show. They call their sound, this is what they say, the Kings of Crownsville: "We take great tunes, add a touch of New Orleans, a pinch of jazz, a hint of world beat, and ground it all in solid alt-rock sensibility." So the Kings of Crownsville later in this hour of the show. Let's cover some news first. The Baltimore City Detention Center originally opened as the city jail on the east side of the city in 1807, notorious for its decrepit conditions, including filth, rodents, black mold, broken elevators, rusty shower stalls, and overcrowding. The detention center was also the focus of a stunning federal indictments in April 2013 that highlighted gang-related corruption inside the facility. The indictment led to 40 convictions. 24 of them were state prison guards. Other convictions included members of the Black Gorilla family, which the federal authorities said had taken over the jail. Yesterday, Governor Larry Hogan stood in a courtyard of the facility and announced he was shutting it down immediately. Melody Simmons was there. Midday producer Melody Simmons attended the press conference. Melody, how you doing?
Hey, Dan. I'm doing great. Thanks.
This took everybody by surprise.
Yes, I think there was a lot of surprise, although the conditions had been very controversial for many years. Of course, the indictments, the corruption. So there was not that element of surprise for that part of it.
Yeah, he criticized previous administrations for keeping the place open.
Scathing. Indeed, yes. He talked a lot. It was almost like Chris Christie himself had written his remarks about Martin O'Malley, because he really lit into him and said that it was shameful how the prior administrations and even the General Assembly had kind of, you know, closed their eyes and not taken any action on this.
The governor said this was immediate, but actually it would take a few days or a couple of weeks, did they say?
Well, we were led to believe that it's imminent, meaning that they could be starting to move some of the detainees today.
Here's what some of what the governor had to say yesterday.
I've ordered the secretary to do it as expeditiously as possible, and I asked them to start immediately, as in today. For security reasons, we can't tell you exactly where they're going or exactly when they're moving, but I can tell you it's going to be closed immediately, and everybody will be moved out as quickly as we can possibly do it in a safe way.
And how many prisoners are in there now, did he say?
The total population is 1,092, but there are 750 male detainees only who are impacted by the move and the closing. It's the men's detention center. That's the part of the complex, which is 12 buildings, that will be closed.
Well, of course, this has been the center of controversy here for a couple of years. The state actually took over the city jail. That's why the governor was able to make this decision. The state took over in 1991. So even though it's called the city jail, it's the Baltimore City Detention Center. It's run by the state of Maryland.
Correct.
Tara Huffman is joining us again, director of the Criminal and Juvenile Justice Program at Open Society Institute of Baltimore, to give some perspective on what this means in terms of criminal justice in Baltimore and corrections. Tara, thanks for joining us again.
Thank you for the invitation, Dan.
Yeah, and I just, before we got on the air, received a release, a statement from OSI, the Open Society Institute of Baltimore, endorsing this closure, calling it a notorious facility that for decades posed a serious risk to detainees, to staff, to family members, and the broader Baltimore community. What are the concerns of OSI at this point?
So, again, we do endorse and applaud the closing of this facility. As you said, it's a facility that has stood far too long and posed danger to far too many. Our immediate concerns are, so what's next? Because simply transferring everyone at the facility to other facilities, and I use the plural because I can't imagine that there's one facility anywhere else in the region that can absorb all of them. So they're going to be dispatched to different facilities. Where are these facilities? And what does the transfer mean for their ability to actively participate in their defense? Because again, I want to remind folks that the majority of folks currently incarcerated at the detention center, the part that's going to be closed, or have not been convicted of a crime.
Right.
They're awaiting trial.
Mm-hmm.
So they need to be able to continue to actively participate in their defense, which means they need to be easily accessible by their defense counsel, which will continue to be a Baltimore City public defender. So where are they going, and are they still going to be able to have access to the justice that is due them? Secondly, are their family members going to be able to reach them? Because, again, they're relying on family members and other community supports to help them in their defense and also help them with their eventual reentry back into the community. We know that public transportation between Baltimore and the rest of the region is abysmal. So families that don't have access to their own vehicles rely on public transportation to get to the detention center to see and support their family members. If those family members are transported to other counties surrounding Baltimore, the public transportation isn't going to be able to ferry those families to see their family members in these other facilities. And so we're very concerned about family preservation. So we want to make sure that they can still get access to their attorneys and that they can still maintain family ties and ties to their communities, even though they're not physically still in Baltimore City. And then I think sort of overriding that is also this question of the people who are currently detained within that part of the jail system, do they need to be detained? Because all of the research and studies that we have seen and even help support say that there are a number of people there who could safely be released into the community, some with supervision, others without supervision, while they're awaiting trial. In other words, we don't have to lock them up while we're waiting to determine whether or not they are, in fact, guilty of the crime that they've been accused of. But they can be in the community. They can be working, maintaining their jobs. If they have health issues, they can be maintaining their health, you know, getting access to health resources. And so what we would like to see and what we strongly urge the Department of Public Safety to do is to apply a validated risk assessment to every single one of those individuals and determine scientifically and objectively who needs to be transferred to another facility because they do, in fact, pose a risk, or who can be released. In other words, they don't have to continue to be incarcerated. They can actually be released into the community, which will further help save money
Tara,
for the state and taxpayers.
I have a question about that, though. Can't we assume that a judge has already made that decision by setting bail or setting conditions of the pretrial detainees?
So a decision was made at some point at the beginning when they were first arrested, booked, and then charged with the offense. But we take issue, again, with the way that those decisions are happening, because, again, they're happening in a way that really isn't based in objectivity. They're looking at the charges. They're looking at the person's criminal history. But we also know, and again, studies have shown us, and even a study of the way bail is set in Baltimore City shows that that process tends to be very arbitrary. There are people who are charged with much more serious crimes and have much more serious histories who are, they get bail set lower than someone who is charged with a less serious offense and has a less serious criminal history because it's not standardized.
I get you. A couple of questions here for Melody Simmons. Back to Melody on this. And Tara used the word facilities, plural, and the governor, I guess, I don't know if he used that word or not, facilities, but he said for security reasons, we can't tell you exactly where they're going or exactly when they're moving. But what would these facilities be? Would they be state? Would they be prisons?
They were very sketchy on that. They were asked specifically a couple of times during the question and answer period of the press conference, and they wouldn't answer it. They said that they will remain in Baltimore City. Where? We don't know. They're state facilities run located
in the city. Right. If they said, well, we'll farm some out to the counties, to their detention centers, but that,
no.
That's not the plan. The plan to keep. So, Tara, do you have any insight as to what that could be? Where those...
Yeah, I can. I'm looking at all the facilities in Baltimore City. I mean, I know that there is a state prison. I mean, there's Supermax, and maybe Supermax has some capacity. But, of course, then I immediately go, wait, whoa, these folks are not they're not prisoners. They're detainees. They have not been convicted of a crime. And so, we really wouldn't, be in favor of mixing them with any population that is in fact, serving time for an offense.
I
think these individuals need to be kept separate if they're going. Again, if it demonstrates that they should continue to be incarcerated while they're waiting their offense, or they're among the smaller percentage of people that have in fact been convicted and they're just serving their time out in the detention facility because their sentence is so short, we just want to make sure we don't get into mixing populations. And I want to give public safety the benefit of the doubt that they're not just going to do this haphazardly or willy-nilly, but I think that this is something that the community needs to have. We need to know. It just shouldn't be up to public safety. The community and the city needs to be part and parcel of what's happening right now.
Tara, thank you very much. Tara Huffman, Director of the Criminal and Juvenile Justice Program for the Open Society Institute of Baltimore. Thank you for making those points. So this is very interesting because the governor says immediately,
imminent.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
Imminent. So, but where?
They won't say. It's very mysterious. And when pressed, would not answer the question. So these are big questions that remain, especially if you have a family member.
750 was the operative number you were given?
Correct.
For those that need to be moved.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the governor went ahead with this decision despite a legislative recommendation on what to do with the city jail. He said it's just time to shut it down.
Right.
Some people are applauding him for this sort of Schaefer-esque do-it-now approach to this thing. Others are saying, not even the mayor of Baltimore was consulted on it.
That's right. The mayor wasn't consulted. According to Chris Connolly of the YPR News staff, he called the mayor's office, and she knew nothing of it earlier in the day.
Chris called.
Yes, Chris called.
The mayor. The mayor's statement released yesterday through her spokesman, Howard Libet. The mayor has long had concerns about the condition of this facility. She looks forward to hearing more details from Governor Hogan's administration about its plans. So pretty terse.
Very terse.
We didn't get a phone call about this, nor did legislative leaders or anybody when it came to this. So we'll have to see, I guess, what happens next. Did the governor address whether there's a plan to tear the building down?
He didn't. He didn't say what was going to happen with the building. He said it will definitely not be a jail anymore.
Okay. Melody, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Melody Simmons, Midday producer, who was on the scene there at the governor's press conference yesterday. This is Midday Friday. Dan Roderick's here. We'll take our first break. When we get back, laptops for guns. Laptops for guns. Not guns for laptops.
Yeah.
I don't know which way it goes. It's one way or the other. But Lance Lucas will be joining us, founder of Digital All Systems, a nonprofit offering a pathway to IT jobs for Baltimore's young people. Digital All Systems also recently organized its third annual event to trade laptops for guns to reduce violence, get laptops in the hands of kids. We're going to talk to Lance Lucas when we get back. And this is Midday Friday. Dan Rodericks here. Lance Lucas is the founder and chief executive of Digit All Systems, a nonprofit devoted to training young people for careers in technology. Digit All Systems founded in September 1998. Lance works with many of the city's public schools to bridge the digital divide. Also, making an effort here to try to reduce violence in Baltimore City and get more computers in the hands of young people and get them on their way into computer careers, he hopes, by offering laptops in exchange for guns. This is the third year in a row that Lance's organization did this. Last year, they were able to get 37 guns off the streets of Baltimore. Lance, thank you so much for joining us. Lance Lucas.
Thank you for having me, sir. I really appreciate the opportunity to speak to your listening public.
Yeah, let's talk a little bit about Digital All Systems first. Tell us about your nonprofit.
Well, my nonprofit focuses on job training, certifications, and testing in the IT arena for low-income, underserved populations, even returning citizens. So we focus on certifications because that makes it valid in any country when a person can get certified as a computer technician, an ethical hacker, or a network engineer.
And do you run classes?
Yes, we do classes 6 days a week. Currently, we have students from Youth Works 5 days a week, and on the weekends, we have students from the Baltimore City Schools CTE program, Career Technology Education Program, from 10 different schools all over the city that they're looking to study network engineering. And we're being funded this summer by the ABLE Foundation for that program.
Well, that's excellent. By the way, I want to make sure that listeners understand that the name of your organization is Digit All Systems, not Digital All Systems. Digit.
It's a play on words.
Right?
Whole system needs to be digital, not just a segment of the population.
I get it.
Digital divide.
Digit All Systems. The classes are at the Downtown Cultural Center on Howard Street?
We had a class there before, but right now we're doing classes at the Urban League at 512 Orchard Street, 6 days a week. That's where we're holding our classes currently. And I have my own office at 200 East Lexington Street, where we do, we test over 7,000 people a year in employment testing, GED testing, as well as certification testing.
That's the historic Orchard Street Church.
Absolutely. It's, 1837 the building was built, and Harriet Tubman used to use it for the Underground Railroad, and I think that it's appropriate that it's part of the legacy of freedom and enlightenment that we have created a certification center for the Urban League there and are holding these classes.
So let's talk a little bit about the swap idea, laptops for guns, these specifically Google Chromebooks for guns. And this was the third year you held this event last weekend. But go back for me, Lance Lucas, 2 or 3 years to when you came up with this idea.
Well, Computers for Guns, or Stop Shooting, Start Coding, I was doing professional development for a group of teachers. And I said to the instructors, I said, listen, we need to take the guns out of their hands and put computers in their hands, as I was talking about the students. And I woke up the next day, and I was like, you know what? Why don't I try that? So at our first year, we took some refurbished computers, some older laptops. We got the students to put hard drives in there. We bought adapters, and we set up some computers. Our first year, we were at the Downtown Cultural Arts Center, and we set up food and a DJ and guest speakers, and we had people come in, and we collected 57 firearms. A lot of people didn't think we'd get one firearm, but we received 57, which it was astounding that people would trade for laptops.
And does that mean 57 laptops went out?
Yes, 57 laptops went out. I was prepared to give away 150 just in case.
And Lance, how do you know who ends up with a laptop? I mean, your aim is for young people who don't currently have one to have one, right? Is that your aim?
Well, the aim is when I started, I didn't know who I was going to get to come to buy. And what we begin to see is it wasn't a lot of the young people that were turning in the firearms. But what we were getting was the aunt or the uncle or the grandmother. And a lot of times these firearms that are forgotten in the closets or under the bed are the same guns that young people go and grab when they're confronted with a situation. And so in the first year, we had one young man who gave his uncle three of his firearms to turn in for him because they were unsure what this program was about. It was still a lot of uncertainty about. We've never heard this before. So a lot of the older folks turned them in, but they also, out of 57 firearms, I'm sure one of those firearms would have been used in the commission of the crime. So if one life was saved, it was definitely worth it.
And Lance, you hear from, you mentioned aunts, grandmothers, they say, you know, I've got a young person at home who doesn't have a computer at home. That's who's going to get it?
Absolutely. What ends up happening is I heard from so many parents. I had one first year, a gentleman came with his son, and he said, I couldn't afford to give my son a computer for back to school, so I traded him one of my firearms, and he can have a computer for school now. And it's usually for, like, the one person I said turned in three firearms for his nephew. His nephew wanted those computers to utilize to do something creative. Like Bill Gates and Steve Jobs and Mark Zuckerberg started out with that one computer. And you can make $1 billion with the right program or app. So we're trying to offer an alternative to violence, or at least put the ideology out there.
Now, I'm curious about this. So you do the swap. A laptop goes into a home. Let's say there's a teenager in that home, or mm-hmm. maybe someone 19, 20 years old, hasn't gotten on track yet for a job. And have any of those people, young people, come into your program for classes?
Yes, we've had we offer free classes along with the computers, and we actually have a class next Saturday for a group of folks that the last group of folks that turned in the firearms.
Oh, great!
And we're doing a Google certification class. So that means folks actually walk away with a certification to learn how to use Google Documents, Google Calendar, Google Hangouts, and they actually get to put an insignia on their resume once we certify them in Google.
Now, talk a little bit about computer technologists, will you? Because I know you have classes in that, and you like to tell them about the opportunities there and the mm-hmm. potential earnings. We've talked about this on the show a good deal, about the number of job openings in Maryland in IT.
Yes, I'll give you, there's about 20,000 open IT positions in Baltimore City right now from an entry level. And I'll just give you a little statistic. There was a study that came out called The Long Shadow by Johns Hopkins in June 2014.
Oh, yeah. But we had Carl Alexander. He was a guest mm-hmm. on our show.
Absolutely. 97% of people born in poverty in Baltimore die in poverty over a 25-year
yep.
study.
Yeah.
We've trained 102 students from one particular program from the Housing Authority of Baltimore City. It's called Youth to Work through the Mayor's Office of Employment Development. We trained 102 students. And out of those 102 students in the three-month training, 62 of them went directly into employment for over $12 an hour. Okay, and then out of that 100 that we trained, 25 of those young people went to work at companies like Boeing, Lockheed Martin, and the Department of Defense, out of the housing projects of Baltimore City, and also from homeless shelters. We had teams from homeless shelters. So we found in numbers, in real numbers, that technology education can break the back of poverty. The average salary of an A-plus certified person, which takes about 3 months, is $15 to $25 an hour. In 3 months, you can earn that certification. So we're really excited about introducing this concept of technology education as a weapon against poverty. And we've been communicating with Mr. Michael Cryer at One Baltimore about building this as one of the pillars of One Baltimore.
So some of the students move up in certification, right? They start at that first level of certification and move up to different levels.
Absolutely. We have a four-pathway certification that we recommend. First, A+, learn how to fix a computer. Next, Network Plus, how do you network computers? And the next certification is Security Plus, how do you secure this network? Because that starting salary is between $65,000 and $80,000. And the fourth certification that we recommend puts you in a six-figure range. It's called Ethical Hacker 1 and 2. And Terrell Williams, one of our students that's 25, he got his Ethical Hacker certification. Within a week, he was offered $135 an hour from the Department of Defense, an hour to work for DOD and secure the network. So we need cybersecurity workers. The D.C., Maryland, Baltimore area, we're like the Silicon Valley of cybersecurity. And there's a lot of jobs out there, and I've been talking to Homeland Security and officials from Google, and they said we need these people to be certified for our own national security.
Hey, Lance, I want to thank you for being on the show today for one reason alone, just to introduce me to the phrase ethical hacker.
White hat hackers.
Yeah,
right?
That's a new one on me, so I'm learning something here. The second year of your SWAP program, by the way, what did you call it? You call it Computers for Guns, right?
Mm-hmm.
Stop Shooting, Start Coding.
Absolutely.
So the second year, you got 37 guns.
Yes.
Now, this year was less. Am I right? Fewer guns came in.
Yes, we received 17 guns this year. What ends up happening is the climate has changed in Baltimore City. Okay, the tension between law enforcement and the community is up, and we all recognize this fact. And so we had to have extra police officers on the scene, which I appreciate Baltimore City Police Force being there. But it was more difficult to schedule and to plan because we had extra security measures that we had to take into consideration. But because of the extra security measures that we had to take, the perception of it was, had folks call me afterwards over, still trying to offer firearms. And I said, I can't take them now. But they saw how many officers were there, and they saw the yellow tape, and they said, they were a little apprehensive. Usually we have one officer, one car, but we had a heavy police presence. But I do know that we are going to do it for a fourth year. I definitely appreciate the Baltimore City Police and the mayor's office for partnering with us in One Baltimore. But I know that there's still a lot of tension in the community right now. So that's the reason we had the low turnout. A lot of people turned around when they saw how many officers were there. Mm-hmm.
Still, 17 guns is 17 guns. 17 computers went out. By the way, where do you get your funds? You're a nonprofit. You're a 501c3?
We're 501c3, not-for-profit, but we're social entrepreneurship, or what I call conscious capitalism. We're 92% self-funded through services. So what we did is we took some of that 92% self-fundedness and we paid for it. When we first did it, we paid for the parts out of our own operation costs, and this time we bought these brand-new computers and brand-new tablets out of our operating costs. So we all tightened our belts to save up the money, because we think it's that important to get the discussion going in the community about, as an alternative violence, about education, specifically technology education. We think it's that important that we're willing to eat a couple of peanut butter and jelly sandwiches for a few months. Just to make it happen.
Lance, is this what you do full time? This is your thing?
Absolutely. I've been doing this full time since 2005. This has been my only job, and I love doing it. We are 2 out of 3 certification centers in Baltimore. We own the only cybersecurity certification center in D.C. and in New Orleans. So we plan to spread it, but we plan to grow the bigger base here in Baltimore, and it requires my full-time attention.
Lance Lucas has been our guest here in this segment of the show. If you want some more information, the website to look for is Digit All Systems. You can find information about it on the Dan Roderick's Facebook page, or find it on Twitter. We tweeted out some photographs and a link to your website a little while ago, Lance. So, yeah, a good job. It sounds like a great thing you're doing here. Come and visit us in the studio when you get a chance.
Absolutely. Yeah. I'm at the White House today, but I'll definitely come and visit you.
You're at the White House? Oh, what's going on, Lance? Tell us about it.
Well, I'm at the White House today, where I'm also president of the Baltimore Black Chamber of Commerce and the State of Maryland Black Chamber of Commerce. And we're talking about strategies on how to use technology and economic development. And I'm giving a speech also on the uprising in Baltimore and how we can effectively change the course of the community through business and technology development.
Wow. Please say hi to the President and First Lady for us, will you?
Right. Absolutely.
Way to go, Lance Lucas from Digital Systems Baltimore. Thank you very much for being with us.
Have a nice day. Yep. Thank you very much for the opportunity, sir.
Yes, sir. Thank you. Great thing he's doing there. And like I said, if you want some more information, it's Digital Systems based here in Baltimore. We've been speaking with Lance Lucas. All right. Lance Lucas sounds like the name of a baseball player, doesn't it? Actually, we got to talk some baseball. In the next segment of the show, Stan the Fan Charles will be with us from PressBox and PressBox Online. And we're also going to hear some a sweet summer song from the Kings of Crownsville. That's coming up in this last segment of the first hour of Midday Friday. So please stay with us. And welcome back to Midday Friday. Well, we've got some news out of Camden Yards to report. The Orioles are acquiring an outfielder from the Milwaukee Brewers in exchange for a right-handed pitching prospect. Stan the Fan Charles from PressBox and PressBox Online is with us. Stan, how you doing?
I'm doing great. He's a left-hander.
Who's a left-hander?
Zach Davies is a left-hander.
You know what? I'm just reading what they handed me here. So
that's
there's a correction. I stand corrected. Stan, nice to see you.
It's good to see you, Mr. Rodericks.
Yeah. Okay, so Zach Davies is the pitching prospect we are trading off, a left-hander, for Gerardo Parra. P-A-R-R-A.
You got that right. I think he would like that pronunciation.
I don't know. I did a little Italian there.
He's Venezuelan.
He's Venezuelan? Okay.
He's 28 years old, left-handed hitter, left-handed thrower, and he plays all three outfield positions. He's having a career year this year.
Yeah,
Dan,
I see that.
For a guy who's a 279 lifetime hitter, he's hitting 328, and what you really like is this really gives Buck Showalter a reason to pull Manny out of that leadoff spot, because Parra has an on-base percentage this season of 369.
I see that.
Which is pretty good for either me or you, too.
Well, first of all, it's nice to have that bat, 328.
Yeah.
But, yeah, so you put Manny – so this guy can lead off?
This guy, in my opinion, the season he's having this year, he strikes me as a leadoff hitter.
So that moves Manny down to third?
Probably, I see him as third. That's what I see.
And the Orioles need a left fielder who can hit.
Well, they need a corner outfielder that can hit. I mean, you know, I wonder what this says about Chris Parmalee's long-term viability with the club, because maybe this guy plays right field and you move Chris Davis back to first base. Whatever he does, he adds a little bit of length to this lineup right now. And it's a lineup that's had, if you want to pigeonhole it and point to left field, they've got one of the worst left field splits in Major League Baseball this year.
What are the Orioles? It sounds like this is a pretty good deal for the Orioles. I mean,
well, Dan, what it does, though, it's a good deal for August and September of this season. But again, it's a situation where you were short on something going into a season, something didn't work out, and you had to give up a little bit of your future to get this guy. The one thing about Parra, though, unlike Andrew Miller last year, is maybe they feel that they can sign him long-term. He's 28 years old. He'll be 29 next May, and he made $6.2, $6.3 million this year. So maybe he's a three-year 27 or a four-year $36 million guy, and maybe you got an answer out there for a little while.
You know, I didn't say this. Today is the non-waiver trade deadline.
At 4 o'clock.
Okay, what does that mean?
That means that this is the day you can make trade. That's a great question,
because people say, well, you can make a trade anytime. But
what happens is then you're susceptible to other teams either blocking the trade by putting a waiver claim on a player. In other words, you have to obtain waivers on a player after July 31st at 4 o'clock. If we want to turn around next week and trade Matt Wieters, and we've got a great deal lined up with the Phillies, he's got to get through the American League teams to get to where the Phillies could put a claim in and work out a trade with the Orioles.
Oh, I see.
So there's a lot of that going on. I just heard Steve Phillips, the GM of the former GM of the New York Mets for a long time, talking about it was him and Brian Cashman and one other GM were the first ones to really start using blocking in waiver deals, where they would say, no, I'm not going
to
let this guy
and
mess another team up.
Right.
Steve
okay.
Phillips said he put in 400 waiver claims in one day.
Really? Wow, I don't know much about that.
I don't know about that well enough to discuss it, though.
So what does this look like to you? The Orioles making a run for a wild card spot?
It looks like the Orioles feel that that they're a good enough club in a sort of a watered down world that they're saying, hey, we're not so bad. We're going to go for it this year and let the chips fall where they may. If you remember, at this time last year, if I had told you Kansas City and San Francisco are going to play the Game 7 in the World Series,
that's right.
You would have thought I was talking with you with two heads, Stan.
We have time for a couple of phone calls here. If you want to phone us up, we're live talk here, a little bit of sports talk with Stan the Fan from Press Box, 410-662-8780. Toll-free long distance, 866-661-9309. I'm giving that number for our listeners in Southern Pennsylvania or wherever. I mean, people can use a toll-free number from Charles Street, I guess.
They can.
Yeah. Okay, Stan, but there's other things going on. David Price.
Yep.
David Price moves from Detroit to Toronto.
Well, it shows you how quickly things can change. You know, about 10 days ago, people were saying to David Dombrowski, their vice president of baseball operations, and they're saying, hey, are you going to sell? And they were adamant that we're going to be buyers. and then you lose 3-4 games out of 5,
right.
And all of a sudden you're selling.
Yeah.
And that's how quickly that came about. And now they look like they're in full selling mode.
They
traded their closer.
Yeah.
They traded their closer. There's also rumors that they will trade Yoenis Cespedes, the Cuban left fielder, who is also about to become a free agent, a lot more expensive than Gerardo Parra.
Can you give us your take on the Orioles generally now? If you add Parra in here, pitching, hitting, what does it look like to you for the next couple of months?
Well, they've got an excellent bullpen. You know, when you get into the 7th, 8th, and 9th innings, they're excellent. They've got a lot of run production, but they've needed more people on base. Unfortunately, you've sort of wasted a great Manny Machado season by having him batting leadoff and not having people on in front of him. Again, this Parra deal gives them a little bit more lift. I still think they're a little short offensively. And starting pitching-wise, Chris Tillman is really heated up. Chen has pitched well. And Ubaldo, again, had two lousy outings, came back and pitched a brilliant 6 or 7 innings the other night against – who were we playing the other night?
Braves. Atlanta.
The Braves, yeah,
yeah,
right. He had an excellent outing the other night. Miguel Gonzalez been a little iffy. And Kevin Gausman is still probably the wild card here, Dan.
But he looked good the last time, didn't he?
He's looked good two of his last three outings.
Yeah.
And if he looks like that, he could be a little bit of a secret weapon down the stretch.
What does it tell you that we didn't trade off Chris Davis?
Well, it you know, Dan Duquette is, and I did an interview with Dan that we were hoping to get on our website today, and it's already outdated. But Chris Davis is more valuable to the Baltimore Orioles right now in what he can do on the playing field than the prospects he can bring back. The Orioles will offer all three of their impending free agents, the key ones, Davis, Wieters, and Chen.
Yeah,
they will get that guaranteed tender, one-year offer of $16 million, which will allow the Orioles to recoup a draft pick if they leave. So, again, Dan Duquette kind of rolling the dice and saying Wieters, Davis, and Chen are more valuable to helping the Orioles win right now.
Okay, I just want to understand the $16
million bit. Yeah.
That means they get an offer of $16
they
million
for
1 year.
They get a one-year guaranteed offer from the Orioles of $16 million. None of the three of them, I take it back. Matt Wieters may be in an interesting position, may not be as highly sought about, you know, with both the way he's hit this year and his playing every other day. Teams may want to know that he can stay healthy for a whole year. So there's an outside chance that he would take that offer.
The Ravens have started training camp again.
Yes, they have.
Yeah, it's
bright
it's
and early
time.
In the morning. Way too early for me, Dan.
Okay. Is it too early to give us some speculations on the Ravens, how they look?
I think the Ravens' defense is going to be vastly improved this year, and I think Mark Trestman is going to do an excellent job as an offensive coordinator with Joe Flacco and a couple new ingredients they've added to this offense. I'm looking for an 11-12 win season by the Ravens.
Hmm.
They've got a very tough road to hoe early in the season. They play 5 of their first 8 games on the road, but that always means the converse is true. You get into the second half and you're in sort of contention over 500. I think they can do some real damage and be a dangerous team by the end of the season.
So we could have a glorious fall still.
We probably won't have a glorious fall for the Baltimore Orioles.
Well,
but
come on.
But
August
is
going.
They're six games out of first place. They're 2 games out of the wild card right now. So there's a chance. There's a chance.
Okay. Stan, thanks very much for being here again today.
Always a pleasure.
Stan the Fan Charles of PressBox and PressBox Online joins us from time to time to talk a little sports. We're going to hear some music now before you leave. Or you're eager to get outside and get the Joe's Squared pizza.
I want to calm down. I've had cell phone problems for the last 20 hours, Dan.
Oh, really?
Oh, it's
unbelievable. That can drive you crazy.
Yes.
Are you going to be okay?
No, I'm not going to be
Have
okay.
Have a slice of pizza. All right. Stan the Fan Charles. And now the Kings of Crownsville, Steve Johnson, a lead guitarist and singer. Steve, nice to have you in the studio with
us. Thank you. Good to be here.
The Kings of Crownsville, a 6-piece band. And you describe yourselves as your music as, let's see, we take great tunes, add a touch of New Orleans, a pinch of jazz, a hint of world beat, and ground it all in solid alt-rock sensibility. That's what I pulled
how
up.
About
your,
that?
Yeah, I like that.
Who wrote that, by the way?
I don't know. Steve, so how long you guys been together?
The band's been together for close to 10 years, and this configuration's probably been together for about five.
We have Ed Justice, Jim Taverner, Mike McCormick, and David Vermette in the studio with us. Kings of Crownsville are playing. Well, you have a busy schedule, but it looks like you're playing this weekend in Baltimore, right?
We are. Germano's.
Germano's Piattini in Little Italy.
Great place.
It's an Italian restaurant in Little Italy. Of course, it has to be. Wait.
They're shaking their heads over there.
It doesn't have to be an Italian restaurant in Little Italy. There's been an Indian restaurant in Little Italy. There's been an Argentinian restaurant in Little Italy. And there was, for a little while, a Chinese restaurant where Villegas used to be. Anyway. So he has music on the second floor.
Germano's. Yeah, he does. It's a cabaret. They turn it into a cabaret.
And you've been there before.
Yeah. It's a great place to listen to music, actually.
Okay. So we wanted to hear the Kings of Crownsville, and you have kind of a big sound, right? Would you say?
Yeah, we have. Well, take a look right here.
Yeah,
we're filling
keyboards, bass. You have trombone. You have trumpet in there.
Right.
But you brought your sort of doo-wop style
today. Yeah, yeah.
Would you say? Am I correct? Is that what you're going to perform?
Yeah, pretty much. We usually have a full force going, but because this is a studio, we're just going to play a song here and do some
all
harmonies.
Right. So tell me about this song. It's called La-Ti-Da, right?
La-Ti-Da tune, yeah. It's a ridiculous tune, actually, Dan.
That's appropriate for the midday show. Thank you.
It's non-representative of what we do, but everybody seems to like it, and they sing along and put a smile on their face. And
did you write it?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay, because there's a La-Ti-Da song out there somewhere. Did you know that?
I did not know that.
I just was Googling around, and I came across some other recording of a song entitled L-A-T-E-D-A.
Uh-uh.
What's yours?
D-E. L-A-D-E.
L-A.
La-Di-Da.
Oh, La-Di-Da. Okay.
Yeah, we were very careful with that.
All right. Here's Steve and the contingent of the Kings of Crownsville. Again, Ed Justice, Jim Taverner, Mike McCormick, and David Vermette.
Okay. I've been thinking about the whole situation, how the weight of the world is gripping the nation. Don't know what a man can do in the face of this gloom and doom. I could sit around all day and contemplate my navel, start drinking early and pass out at the table, grow a lot of facial hair and howl at the moon. Or I could sing a little la-di-da tune while you wearing that frown. The sun's coming up and the sun's going down. Instead of all this gloom, you gotta start singing a la-di-da tune.
La-di-da.
Everybody knows that the oceans are rising.
La-di-da.
Godzilla has been spotted just beyond the horizon.
La-di-da.
It's snowing down in Texas in the middle of June. We gotta start singing some
la-di-da tune.
Why you wearing that frown?
The sun's coming up and the sun's going down. Instead of all this gloom,
you gotta start singing
a la-di-da tune, la-di-da.
My dog is out barking again at the neighbors,
la-di-da.
I forgot to put the garbage in separate containers,
la-di-da.
Woke up this morning looking like a stoned raccoon. I better start singing some
la-di-da tune.
Why you wearing that frown?
The sun's coming up and the sun's going down. Instead of all this gloom,
I gotta start singing
a la-di-da tune, la-di-da.
This world is an accident that's already happened,
la-di-da.
That was written on a wall down in Lower Manhattan,
la-di-da.
So when you think your mind is about to go boom, you better start singing some
la-di-da tune, la-di-da. La-di-da.
Oh, yeah.
La-di-da.
And have yourself a really nice day.
Oh, that is so much fun, Steve. That's a terrific song. You got a little bit of New Orleans in you, don't you?
Yeah, I do.
Do you grow up in Louisiana?
I spent some of my childhood down there. Yeah.
Okay.
And we all go there an awful lot. It's a big part of what we do is the New Orleans sound.
Oh, really? So you actually perform there?
We haven't performed there.
Or you just visit a lot and listen a lot.
When I die, I'm going to go perform there, actually.
Right. So let me ask the guys. Ed Justice, yes. What do you play in the band?
I play trumpet and backup percussion.
Okay. And Jim Taverner?
Right here.
Jim, what do you play?
Well, mainly trombone, some trumpet, and congas.
Congas. And Mike McCormick?
Keyboards and vocals.
And David Vermette.
Yes, I'm on the bass and vocals.
Right. And so what do you think of this guy, Steve? Anybody have an opinion about it right here in front of him? What do you think of your band?
They're not supposed to say anything.
I'm putting them on the spot. It's because you organize it. Yeah. You said
well,
the best
way. We're here.
I read that where you said the best way to get into a great band is to start one yourself, right?
Yeah,
I didn't
have to audition.
Right. Right. What, so, you want to say something about Steve? I really love his little tune he just did.
Well, I think he's a very creative songwriter, and we really enjoy playing the band. It's a very relaxed situation to be in. It's very creative and original.
Yeah. Yep. All right. And so this weekend at, I like that song so much, I wish there was like three or four more verses.
Well, you want us to do it again?
I don't know. No, what do you think? I mean, I don't know.
No, we did it. Yeah? We did it without,
Stan, what
we
do you
didn't
think?
Blow anything there.
Stan,
I absolutely fell in love with that
song. I like
song.
That little tune, right?
You know, boy, all of a sudden my cell phone problems were a mile away.
And you feel so good.
Yeah, it does put you in a good mood here.
Yeah.
I'm tempted to ask you to do that again, just to play us out maybe.
Sure, we'll play you out.
You want to play it out? Or you don't have any new another verse, do you?
No, we don't.
So you'd have to repeat yourself.
We could put the Dan Rodrick's verse in there.
I don't know. You want to make it up as you go?
No.
You can't do that?
I better not do that. This is live right here, right?
Good. Well, we can play. I'll bring it down to the last minute here. Maybe we can just do the refrain with the guys, maybe, right?
Yeah.
Jump
I'll
in there
it,
somewhere?
I'll take it from...
It's live radio. That's the way you do these things.
Let's take it from the verse before going into the first la-di-da. Okay?
Let me tell you, our listeners, before you do that, Kings of Crownsville, we posted your website so folks can find you there. You've got a CD called Waiting There for Me.
Thank you.
Available
Thank you.
On iTunes
yeah.
and CD Baby. And also this weekend, as Steve said, performing at the cabarets at Germano's Piattini in Little Italy. Saturday
best
night.
Best place to hear music in Baltimore,
yeah.
I think,
really?
Actually.
Well,
yeah.
I mean, that kind of music, right? And that style and that setting.
Yeah,
right?
I really like it a lot.
Why don't you play us out? Yeah, I love
All
that.
All right.
We'll listen to that again. I'm sure our listeners enjoy that. And folks, stick around for the second hour of our show. Leonard Hamm will be joining us, a former Baltimore police commissioner. And Steve Johnson and the guys from Kings of Crownsville will play us out now. And we'll have some Joe Squared pizza during the news and come back for the second hour. Good, Steve.
Why are you wearing that frown? The sun's coming up and the sun's going down. Instead of all this gloom, you gotta start singing a la-di-da tune.
La-di-da.
My dog is out barking again at the neighbors.
La-di-da.
I forgot to put the garbage in separate containers.
La-di-da.
Woke up this morning looking like a stoned raccoon. I better start singing some
la-di-da tune. Why you wearing that frown? The sun's coming up and the sun's going down. Instead of all this gloom,
you ought to start singing
a la-di-da tune.
La-di-da. This world is an accident that's already happened.
La-di-da.
That was written on a wall down in lower Manhattan.
La-di-da.
So when you think your mind is about to go boom, you better start singing some
la-di-da tune.
La-di-da. La-di-da.